Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 133, Buddhism 101, Tara Meditation.
All of these things are just creativity, really. You know, they're like, they're sort of ways of, they're archetypes for relating to sort of the primal energies of the unconscious. The key thing about Buddhist psychology is that it does not believe that the unconscious has to remain unconscious. And in fact, it feels that the purpose of a person who decides they want to really use their human life to the maximum evolutionary advantage, to the most positive way they can use it, the wonderful human intelligence, which they especially do because everyone is a self-made human in a certain way, in the sense that everyone's been every other kind of animal and even a god and even a demon and everything. But having won the human form, it's this ideal form in which to evolve towards Buddhahood, not just toward divinity or heaven, but toward Buddhahood, towards full enlightenment. So therefore you don't want to die with your unconscious still unconscious, because it's like a dream. You don't know which nightmare it's going to produce. You know, whether you're going to be driven by greed, you're going to be driven by jealousy, you're going to be driven by fear and hatred, you're going to, this kind of thing. So you want to be fully conscious of everything within your human life so you can consciously choose how you will be reborn and so forth. And they make a big fuss that like an enlightened person no longer is reborn, because that's what they said in dualistic Buddhism. But what that means in non-dual Mahayana Buddhism, universal vehicle Buddhism, is that no one needs to be reborn driven by unconscious ignorance-based instinct. But once you realize the all good nature of reality, your love for beings, your wish, which is nothing but your automatic wish to share the bliss that you have discovered, it flows out of you, and then you want to be reborn in some way, but you can control where. You know, and that's the whole idea of like something like a Dalai Lama or something, was pretty much uniquely cultivated to the highest degree in Tibet and Mongolia. In India, they had it, of course, but it wasn't institutionalized in the same way. Where they go and find a child, you know, or the child, you know, gets up and says, okay, Mom and Daddy, actually, you know, I'm supposed to go down to that monastery and study because I am the Lama so-and-so and my disciples are behaving badly and I have to go and straighten them out, type of thing, you know. And this started around 13th century and was really great. I used to be against it. I thought there was too much, you know, that the secular, these kind of lamas being like practically, you know, if you were going to run for president in Tibet, you'd not just stand on your record, you have to stand on what you did in your previous lives also. You know, so they would be competing in that way, you know. But then I realized this was the way in which Tibet undid its militaristic conquest empire nature before Buddhism went there. Because the great adepts went there and they spread this choice, this life choice of real bliss, real pleasure, you know, in this very individualistic society, Tibetan, because they were nomadic. You know, nomads tend to be more individualistic than people who live in hierarchical cities and things. And so it's really quite a wonderful system. So those are the systems of the five Buddhas, and there's many different ways of arranging. People want to know, oh, is the north always green, or is this and that? There's just an infinite number of different systems. One of the greatest masters from Bengal who went to Tibet, Atisha, and he went there because he had a green Tara always talked to him. He actually had a statue that would talk to him and tell him what to do. He would ask the statue and it would talk. But it was her, actually. She would just animate the statue when he asked her a question. And she sent him to Indonesia, for example, to recover certain teachings of love and compassion for when he was there 17 years. That they'd been lost a little bit in India, which had become a little bit decadent. And then he was invited to Tibet, and she said, well, if you go there, your life will be shortened by about 20 years, but you'll make 12, 15, 18 more years there. But what you do there will have a much bigger impact than just staying here for a longer period in India, so go ahead. And I forgot why I was in Tisha. I had a reason. But, oh yeah, yeah. But he was a prince of a royal family in Bengal, and he was already a big Buddhist scholar, and he was very into it. And then one night he had a dream, and all a bunch of Dakinis, which are these female deity spirits, I think, they came to him in a dream, and they said, "Oh, we hear you're like a great scholar, and that you really like Tantra. We heard. And would you like to see a few tantras? We have maybe a few extra you haven't seen that you might like. And would you like to see them?" "Oh yeah, I'd really like to see them." But he thought he was a big master, you know. So then they showed up with a giant steamer trunk. But this was in a dream. And when he opened the steamer trunk, he didn't recognize a single title of the huge bunch of tantras that were there. So, you know, he was humbled by how much knowledge he didn't have. And so then they said to him, "Oh, you'd like to learn a few more of these, maybe?" And they said, "Well, then why don't you get serious and quit being a prince and go be a monk and get into serious study?" Which he did, which is contrary to how people think. They think tantrikas are always out, you know, like running around in the jungle. But actually, he went into the tantric deities made him go into the university because it's so sophisticated and technical. There's so much to study about it. And like I think in the future, you know, shamanism, you know, since it was non-literate oral thing pretty much, and in small communities of indigenous people, tribes and things, but now when it's being collected kind of by yourself and by modern people who sort of can do comparative shamanism, I think it's going to be like stacked, a lot of it will be stacked up and organized, and, you know, the Stan Groffs and the Isa Guicciardis and other kind of people like that. And in a while, we'll see that. But India, that they did that a long time ago. You know, India is really the big mother. Like Dalai Lama himself goes around nowadays and he says, "I'm not really from some Tibetan Buddhist sect or something. I'm a son of Nalanda University," which was the great, great 1,000-year or 1,200-year university in central India, you know, that was burned down in the 12th century by one guy from Tajikistan, you know, a silly guy, you know. And after he took the golden statues out, he burned the library. It was said that the 9-story library of that monastery burned for 3 months. It's said, it was like Library of Alexandria, sort of thing. You know? So does that answer that? I mean, there's a lot more about it. But one thing, just so there are many different versions depending on many different people's needs. And it's not like there's just one thing, and that's what Tantra is. That's the point. All methods of making the world beautiful for others is what it's about. That's what mandala means, you know? Mandala means a protecting circle for the mind, actually. Manda means essential place or circle. So mandala is, and like, I had one teacher, Dalai Lama's senior teacher was one of my teachers, great man, passed away like long ago, but he always said, if anybody tells you that such and such a mandala, this or that, is in some place, they don't know what they're talking about. Meaning that every atom has any mandala, you know, if you know how to like visualize it and create it and occupy it, you know, and meet the people, the entities that do occupy it. And so on. But indeed. You mentioned about protector. Actually, what they call protectors are usually some kind of like lower angels. You know, those Buddhas are not into protecting in the sense of problems or obstructions, things like that. The Buddhas are into helping you do soul retrieval, soul development, evolve toward Buddhahood, this kind of thing. But they're kind of archangelic things because the Buddhas never destroy demons. They make them, they put them to work, you know, they harness them. They take their power, they get them to use their forceful and destructive power in positive ways. And the sort of the typical Buddhist myth about like a demon is not destroying the demon. It's taking the demon, chaining them down, and lecturing them interminably for like a few centuries, some of them. until they get it, you know. So getting them to study, in other words. And then use their tremendous energies to protect beings, etc. The most wonderful version of that is the god of death, the Indian god of death, Yama, who has the head of a mahe. And then there's a version of the Bodhisattva of wisdom. He emanates himself as what's called Yamantaka, which means the terminator of death, or the, I like to say, the terminator exterminator, since the death is the terminator, so then the exterminator exterminates the terminator. When death dies, nobody dies, because death is not there to kill anybody anymore. He's, and he has this kind of, he becomes a very important protector of the god of death. So the death of death as a symbol of immortality is a marvelous thing.
Okay. So there's one thing I wanted to say about the practice that we did just now related to what we talked about this morning.
Yeah.
So this morning we were talking about ritual and the power of ritual, and we were talking about the way in which sound and light and movement and dance and, you know, sound and song are they are pathways, and when you involve song or dance or movement into a ritual, what you are doing is you are creating a kind of highway for unseen power to come into the world of the seen, right? So we talked about how rituals will do that, and how sound, when used in rituals, will do that. And so here's a really good example. We're working with the mantra of Tara, and as Bob said, the sound becomes the highway through which, and if you have, you know, a regular practice, if the ritual that you engage in through the practice and the sound that you say becomes the pathway that Tara can enter into your experience and offer you help. So this idea of asking for, say, you know, being saved is not really theoretical when you break it down into understanding the power of sound and its use in ritual that we were exploring today. So I just kind of wanted to make that connection for you.
I'm very, very proud of you all reciting it. So a couple of people not moving their lips. Being lazy. Because when one of my first teachers used to say, when you try to learn something, the verbal like that, you have to go past where your mind starts to tell you, well, now I know this. And you have to let your tongue learn it. If I continue to just ignore the thought that now I know that I don't do this anymore, and do more with your tongue. It's a very good way, it's very helpful to learn a language that way. You know, and let your tongue learn it.
So does anyone else have any questions about any of the material that we've covered?
Yeah. I had a question about the Tara. What was, do you know the name of the, you said there was a famous poem of all 21 Taras?
There's a famous poem.
It's the echo or
something. There's a Sanskrit, the Sanskrit poem that you referred to that is the, that talks about the 21 Taras. Do you know the name of it?
Yeah, well, I'm not remembering it. It's so famous in Tibetan. The Tibetan translation is so nice and wonderful. I can't quite remember the Sanskrit version, I think, because I always recited the Tibetan one, and now I've forgotten it. But I probably have a version of it in my computer. I'll try to bring it tomorrow. But the Sanskrit one is in the Tara Sutra. The problem is that a lot of the Sanskrit books were destroyed, you know, in the great burning that took place by the invaders of India 1,000 years ago. And the Tibetan translations are what we have often. And then sometimes they find a text, and I think there was a one found in Tara Sutra, from the Tara Sutra, and I think it's the same as the 2100. Well, let me look into it, and I'll bring something for you tomorrow.
Even the Tibetan.
But it's wonderful. There's a, you know, there's the golden blazing Tara who stamps her foot and all demons disappear. And then there's the red dominatrix Tara who attracts all the kings and makes them stop fighting and be peaceful. And then there's the, et cetera. You know, each one has a verse of praise, 21 verses. And then they say, if you recite this every day, 3 times, then everything will be so cool. it's like the Buddhist Hail Mary sort of thing, but it's a little more elaborate. And every Tibetan person knows that, and they all recite it all the time. And then, Chatsel Dharma Nyurma Pamo. Chatsel means homage. Dharma means the savior, as you know, Tara in Tibetan. Nyurma means swift one. Pamo means heroine. Chatsel Dharma Nyurma Pamo. Jani Keche Lodan Dhamma. who was born in a lightning flash from the eye of the great compassionate one. That's Avalokiteshvara. That refers to a legend where Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, who's the one on the upper right above her with the white, I mean, there are many forms of him, but that's a famous one. On the right, that one, yes, hold with four arms, white one. And he was meditating for many lifetimes, you know, long life, because he's like a celestial, on human beings becoming more peaceful and less violent and less greedy and less deceitful and all this. And he was noticing with his clairvoyant barbers that they were not improving. He was radiating love and compassion. And so but he had made a vow that if he became discouraged, he wanted to be torn to pieces, his body. So he's getting almost discouraged, and then he cries. He weeps. And then the first two tears that fall from his two eyes, they turn into white and green Tara. And they say to him, "Don't cry, you know. Of course you can't fix all these silly sentient beings. You're just a man, you know. What do you expect? We're going to help take care of it. We can make miracles. Just, you know, keep meditating and we'll work on it." And so that's sort of one of the origin legends of Tara. You know? But then still he gets discouraged later, and then he's split in 1,000 pieces. And then his head is split in 10 pieces. And then his guru, who is in her crown of her head, if you look here, you'll see she has a little Buddha on her headdress, which is proper way of doing white Tara, who's red in color. That's the Buddha Amitabha, boundless light, from the lotus family, the individuating wisdom. And he comes down, and Avalokiteshvara is like 1,000 pieces scattered across the mountainside. Head is shattered in 10. And he said, that Buddha says, like, you should always be careful what you wish for, because sooner or later it will happen. And then blessed him into this 1,000-armed, 1,000-eyed, you know, thing. If you must have seen that, Avalokiteshvara. It's very shamanic myth, in the sense that he's torn to bits, unable to sort of deal with the world suffering, you know. But then the enlightened wisdom, creative wisdom, puts him back together in a much more powerful form. And with a slightly fierce top head, his tenth head is a little bit fierce looking. You know, he was being a little bit of tough love there, fierce compassion. They're wonderful, those legends. They're really nice. They come from India. Even the name Avalokiteshvara, the word Ishvara means God, Avalokita means looking after, caring God. So it's kind of it's a challenge to the Vedic idea of the gods who are fearsome, you know, that there's a caring one. You know? And it relates to the maturing of Indian civilization after Buddha's time.
Can you guys speak to Tibet's indigenous shamanistic tradition, the Bon tradition, and its place within the framework we're working with? I'm asking about Bon, if you guys can speak on the Bon tradition.
Can you speak to the Bon tradition in the Himalayas, the shamanic tradition in the Himalayas of Bon?
Well, Bon,
and its context,
yes,
here,
Bon,
and what
Bon
we're talking about.
Some people think that Bon was shamanism, but that's not true. There was a kind of tribal shamanism in Tibet when Buddhism came there. But before Buddhism came there, a royal cult came with roots in Iran, in the Persian Empire, which was the great empire of the ancient time. And the Tibetan Empire is about 2,300 years recorded old, and even before that probably was longer, but this is the Tibetan year 2158 or something, I forgot exactly. But it's very, very old. And in that time, you know, Iran was a very, very powerful empire. We're stretching from Greece to India and Afghanistan and so on, up into Central Asia. And so there was a royal cult, which was the precursor of Bon, that itself had sort of transmuted shamanistic rites, but like other kind of pharaonic type of rites, they had rather awful things of like interring wives and servants with kings, you know, in their tombs, and animal sacrifice and all kinds of things like that. But yet it was a high sort of royal cult, temple cult. It was not a tribal cult already, you know. And then when Buddhism came in, brought in by a particular emperor at a certain point, he brought it in. So it was a top-down importation. And it displaced that cult. And, you know, again, in the great Buddhist adepts, they stopped the sacrifices, you know. So So then the Burn were kind of upset, you know, there was conflict. And then a few generations later, like after about 150 years of that first importation, there was kind of a reaction where one particular branch of the royal family, some Burn priests got in charge of him, and he said, well, this Buddhist thing is making you too peaceful, it's ruining the empire, the Chinese are going to bug you, some Mongolians, some Turks, you know, the Nepalis, the Bengalis, all the people that had been conquered are starting to push for independence because you're getting all peaceful, all Mani Padme Hum, we're Buddhists and all this. So Burn, you need your Burn cult again, we'll make you powerful again. And that particular guy did, and he suppressed Buddhism for about 100 years. But already by that time, that was like 6 or 7 or 8 generations into Buddhism being there, Buddhism had become popular on the popular level. And people were feeling better about not doing animal sacrifice, and actually people were feeling better not having war all the time, being a conquest dynasty. So in a way they were choosing to be more happy and to be less powerful in the sense of conquering people. And so then Burn decided to get into the Buddhist business, and they created a whole set of scriptures and practices that are exact same as Buddhist, but they said these came from Iran and it was an older Buddha. And so, you know, we had all the same, like Prajnaparamita, everything, and monkhood, and bodhisattvahood, and Buddhahood, every term and word, exactly the same, huge pile of books they somehow created. And so I like to say that the Tibetans became so Buddhist because the great adepts went there and transformed the society, that even the non-Buddhists were Buddhist. And nowadays, Burn in exile, not in Tibet still, but in exile, Burn is considered like the fifth school of Buddhism. And Tenzin Wangyal and people around here who teach Burn are really teaching Buddhism, basically. Totally. And because, but that's called, by the Buddhists, that's called White Burn. Black Burn is a group that is sort of not officially with that White Burn, but they still do some kind of animal sacrifice, and they're very kind of marginal. And then even the White Burn people don't like them, you know, because they do kill animals. Milarepa had a big contest with the famous Burmbo shaman, and there was some kind of competition there. But again, the Buddhists never destroy any other people. They just sort of vegetarianize them and set them aside. And they couldn't be vegetarian in Tibet because that was not the economy. But in those days, but you know, they stopped them from wholly immediately. You know, only, that's all. So Burn is marvelous, and Burn kind of has a kind of link to kind of ancient shamanic and tribal level, but it's a second mediated link. In other words, if Buddhism is the third wave that came, the second wave was the Burn, and the first wave was the tribal shamanism. So some people conflate Burn and think Burn was shamanistic, and actually the other Buddhists in the world, or only since the Dalai Lama came out, have the few of them come to start to appreciate that Tibetan Buddhism preserves the whole of Indian Buddhism and has solid monasticism and solid Mahayanism, and then it has the Tantra as well. Until the 60s, when His Holiness started manifesting that in the Tibetan monasteries being rebuilt in India and all this to some extent. Before that, they all thought that Tibetan Buddhism was corrupted by shamanism, actually, the other Buddhists. Even though in Thailand and Burma and these places, they do have local spirit worship cult. And they once did have Tantra, actually. Sri Lanka had plenty of Tantra and Mahayana. But in the 9th century, there was some political thing and some monastery that was intolerant about Mahayana and Tantra. Like, but it really had to do with the politics of two sons of some king in some dynasty. And one of them won, and then they wiped out the Mahayana Buddhists and the Tantricas. So that's sort of the recent sort of super orthodox, weird Theravadins. Is only recent. Ancient time, most of the Theravadins were also Mahayanists, and also some of them practiced Tantra. And in fact, I would say before the Chinese invasion in 1950, the largest population of Theravada vow-holding monks were the Tibetans. There were more Theravada monks in Tibet than in all of the three sort of major Orthodox Theravada countries, modern Theravada countries combined. Burma was a little, the one with the bar far more than Sri Lanka or Thailand. But because there were so many, you know, Tibetan was so super monasticized, you know. It was like 20% of the people were monks or nuns, which was very good for a population balance. It's a good population control thing. People choosing not to have children voluntarily. So it's quite a good mechanism. You know, the communists in Asia and China, for example, went around shouting about how monasteries are parasites and all this. And, you know, when Mao said, when China has stood up, you know, in 1949, you know, when he took over, there were 600 million Chinese. And then they'd had one child policy and all these terrible things for a while, you know. And now there's 1.2 billion. I think they were evading the policy. They doubled their population. Whereas if they had even 2 million monks and nuns, and in Taiwan there's tons of nuns. Oh, the Chinese nuns are super duper. They're like, you know, like lawyers and scientists, and they're fantastic. They don't want to be bugged around by the Chinese men. And they run around, you can walk around a corner in Taipei and get trampled by a herd of them. They go, a gaggle of nuns, they go shooting by. They're so intelligent. I've had several PhD students who were Taiwanese nuns. So bright and brilliant. And they, believe me, they are not waiting to be taken out by Donald Trump on Saturday night. We have lost males, you know. We're like, we're educated, we're enlightened, we're like, have our inner streaming, we don't need all that. They're really great, you know. We have the wrong idea about monasticism in the West because we associate it with, you know, terrible, you know, name of the crows and people boiling each other in oil and then people being repressed, we think, you know, but not really, actually. It's just there when you don't have the ordinary householder outlets of that energy and you don't simply suppress it, and you have some sort of meditative technology, then you can feel that inner, like Teresa of Avila, Hildegard of Bingen, look at them. They were like streaming with vital energy, you know, precisely because they gave up the normal huffing and puffing.
Okay, any last questions? Yeah.
Could you speak, both of you, to the different realms within the dream states?
You first. What was it? It was about the dream states?
About the dream states. Are you speaking about, like, the Bardo? Well, if I could answer that question, I'd like to answer that question in a particular way that incorporates both shamanic practice and Buddhist practice,
sure,
if that's
sure.
Okay.
Well, yeah, sure.
So, and I know that my description of the six lokas is a little, I learned it slightly differently than you did, so I'm sorry if it's a little bit
off. Well, you'll bump into me if you...
I know.
I haven't
incorporated what you
but
said.
But that's okay.
You have to tell me again.
All right.
So, remember this afternoon we were talking about the inner cosmography of the shamanic worldview, and we talked about the upper world, the middle world, and the lower world. So the middle world is, as we said, the place where you find compassionate spirits, but you also find uncompassionate spirits, right? And the uncompassionate spirits that you find in shamanic practice are described as, beings that are trying to take something from you or, you know, install themselves in your psychic field and take something from you from that vantage point. Or, you know, they're kind of up to... The essential understanding about middle world spirits who are not compassionate in nature is that they have lost connection with their own sources of life energy, and therefore they are trying to tap into other sources of life energy that people have that they don't have. And you find people in bodies doing the same thing. You know, most codependent relationships are that, right? Where you have one person who's got an aspect of themselves that they won't inhabit, so the other person comes in and inhabits it, and then there's an exchange where the other person's not inhabiting part of their being, and the other person comes in and inhabits it, and now they have a relationship, and now they can't leave because they'll both be hurt if, and then people stay in relationships like that way too long, right? So those are the kinds of relationships that middle world spirits also form with people, right? So in Buddhism, there's this concept of the six lokas. And the six lokas in some forms of Buddhist thought are considered to be actual realms or lands that are characterized by particular beings who are characterized by particular kinds of emotion. And in other levels of Buddhist practice, the six lokas are conceived of as states of mind. And
I must say, only modern materialists try to do that.
Right.
It's not in any form of Buddhism. Absolutely not.
Really?
No. It's just made up by Trungpa, people like that who are catering to Western materialists.
Really?
Absolutely.
Oh.
Without form and future life, there's no path, practice of Dharma as far as Buddhism goes.
Okay.
In all countries.
Okay.
Except until now. Okay. Now there are people saying, well, we want to be Buddhists without form or future life. Which
is
fine.
But I'm not saying that there's no form or future life. I'm just saying that the lokas are considered to be a state of mind in some levels of Buddhist practice.
Well, yeah, the different lokas, lokas is actually not quite the right word. The different migrations, they call it, or jagat, the Sanskrit word, you know, where people go, they migrate through death into those places, the heavens, the titans, animals, the hungry ghosts, and they're not ghosts, actually, hungry beings, and hell, and the human is the other one. And one goes in there compared to being a human by intensifying particular negative poisons.
Right.
So they are particular negative states of mind, actually, all five of them.
Right, right, right.
And five non-human ones. And the humans, luckily, have all of the negative things. So they balance each other, something like that.
Okay.
So out of six migrations rather than worlds, they're not really considered separate worlds. They're just options for rebirth. And five of them are, you know, if a god is pride, you know, the intensification of pride. The titans are an intensification of jealousy. The animals are intensification of stupidity and ignorance. The hungry beings, which are not ghosts, are the intensification of greed, lust, and the hells of hatred. But that doesn't mean that when you're in hatred, you're in hell. Or when you're hating something, you're in hell, or when you desire. So you can't really say they're states of mind. But they are incarnations that are driven by someone being predominantly focused on one or the other of the poisons, being completely driven by more, but everybody's driven by all of them, but more predominantly by those. Okay.
So that's a really good description of the middle world, right? So these are the different states that you find in the middle world.
I apologize for interrupting, but the only reason
it's okay.
Is that, you know, remember Meister Eckhart?
Yes.
Our dear Meister Eckhart? I mean Eckhart Tolle. Our modern Oprah's Meister Eckhart. Well, his big thing was get out of everything and be in the now, right?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not Meister Eckhart, although I do know him, actually, and I quite challenged him on this, which over pasta, and he was quite appreciative. And my thing is multiple lives. It's a huge effort. It's a huge effort for any of us who grew up in this materialist world where the scientific authorities assure us that they've discovered that having a future life, having the soul continuum, subtle mind continuum after death is some primitive backward thing. And we're Americans and we're living for this life. We're going for the gusto, we're going for the gold, and never mind what happens because we'll be nothing when we die. It's very hard, even though we may already have a spiritual or mystical idea. It's hard for us to really viscerally feel that about that. But it says it's more powerful than Eckhart's thing even of being in the moment, like it's getting out of all expectations and all fantasies and all memories, and which is quite powerful, and just sort of really being here now, right? Ram Dass, and it's like a big deal. And it's kind of a nice big deal, but if you think that what the reality of now is that at its base there's nothing, because you have no soul or mind, then your now moment is kind of isolated from other things. Whereas if you're aware of yourself as this beginningless and endless continuity, what you get committed to is the quality of your continuity. It's like, you know, you're gonna be going and taking that bus to New York, so you wanna know that the driver knows the road, it's on the right place, and you're gonna get out at the right stop. You know, you're concerned for somewhere where you know you're gonna be continuing. And this changes the quality of your life dramatically. And so I'm sorry, but I just had to emphasize, underline, dot, dot, dot. And my slogan is, in relation to the Ben Book of the Dead, nobody gets out of here a dead. Which then changes the way you are here, you know, very, very much. Right? Because there's consequences. Everything has unlimited consequences. Mm-hmm. So the smaller you become mindful of the smallest positive thing, you want to make it just a little more positive than not negative. Anyway, that's all. I just wanted to explain my rude of interruption.
But
please go ahead.
I would always rather listen to
please
you.
Go ahead,
to
please go ahead.
Always. So I think your question got answered, yeah?
I don't think
so. No, the dream. No, no, actually, no, help her with the dream. You know, we did the lower
okay, so,
dream state.
So, you want to state your question again then?
It was, what about the dream state?
Six dream states, or however many dream states, are we to experience them while we're awake or in the daytime? Are these dream states that we only enter when we're sleeping or when we're passing through death?
She's asking about the bardos of dream and sleep and death.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's a practice. You know, you can think of sleeping as rehearsing dying, and you can sleep of dreaming as rehearsing being in the between, and waking up as rehearsing being born. And in a way, there is a practice like that. I mean, that's a very high practice, actually.
It's called dream yoga.
It's like the shamanic thing. You don't want to go off contacting any old spirit without guidance. So, you know, it's the basic thing that you, when you become unconscious in the sleep, you have hit the level of the dark light, having gone through the white light and the orange, golden sunlight, and the moonlit white light, and then you hit the dark light, and then you conk out and you go to sleep. But project that you are in the clear light, infinite positive energy enfolded. That's really where you are. You're not just completely out of it. So that then makes you safe. And if it's hard to sort of make that feel visceral, you have like a relationship with the White Tara, with your shamanic teacher, with whoever it is, someone who you kind of trust, who you feel can navigate these things, and then you feel they're present with you, and that you may have a lesson to learn in the in-between state, in the dream state, and then you might have some kind of message from the dream. You know, then they have all that lucid dreaming stuff where you do journaling and you do all that. But you don't have to get into how this is going to be a bardo and everything. But if you do prepare well for the bardo, if you learn to lucidly dream, that is to know you're dreaming without waking out of the dream, and then kind of be more mindful in the dream of what you're learning, and then carry over the memory more into how you're awakened. And if you're in a shamanic path with a shamanic teacher, they'll introduce you maybe to elements of nature, but that's for her to talk about. I believe that. In the Buddhist one, you have, you're in a mandala maybe, or it depends on what you're practicing and visualizing. Even you visualize your own body in the dream state as a Tara, you might, for example, at a certain advanced level, or at least you feel the presence of a Tara at a beginning level. There are different types of them, yeah. So, but you know, you don't have to make it a whole huge thing right off the bat.
I think I'm getting a sense in my own life as I grow and age that I'm at a point where I sense that I can be learning while I'm sleeping, not just while I'm awake and being alert here. So I'm thinking you were talking possibly to that with lucid dreaming, asking for protection in some way prior to sleeping to allow that to happen safely.
But actually, dreaming is a very, very important source of information. In the mid-90s, when email was coming in, I used to give a lecture, dreams : email from the higher self. Right? I was very hip.
Pretty good.
I still use it sometimes, you know, but as a name of a lecture. But dreams are very important. And, you know, Bob's talking about dream yoga. This is one way of working with dreams. But there are many ways to work with dreams. And if you want to cultivate a relationship with your dream life, you're exactly right, where you put your attention toward it and really begin to understand that your guidance can be speaking to you through your dreams, and really take your dreams as the guidance and sit down and begin to try to understand them in that way. And this morning when I was talking about interpreting the images and the journey and the images and dreams, one of the ways that you work with your dreams is by learning how to open those images for yourself. And so what you would want to do if you want to cultivate a dream practice is, as you're falling asleep at night, give yourself the suggestion that you will be able to remember either a complete dream or a piece of a dream, or even the feeling that you have as you're awakening. Don't feel like you have to have the whole dream in order to receive insight. And then as you're becoming awake, just before you realize, oh, I'm coming awake, drop back down into where you had just come from rather than continuing out into the room. And see if you can perceive where you were, gather whatever part of the dream is still there. And then without getting up, without going to the bathroom, without even turning on the light, record the dream or write it down. Because as you all know, it's as soon as you move, the dream goes.
That's really good.
So then, and then have a journal that you keep and you look through your dreams, you know, like write your dreams down. And then have a moment in your meditation practice where you're looking at your dreams. And one of the things that we do in the dreams class is we look at, okay, I can interpret a dream by opening the image. What does this image remind me of? How do I feel when I'm in the presence of this image? This is a way to open the image. Have I ever seen this image before? In what was that context? And then another way to look at your dreams is to look at the recurring feeling states that are emerging. And then you can take, if you have a journey practice or a Vipassana meditation practice, you can take the feeling state that's arising from the dream and look at it, examine it within the meditative state. And this is a very important thing to do, is to begin to move the information from the dreams into the meditation or the journey, or from the meditation and the journey into the dreams. You can send information back and forth in this way. So you truly, dreams are a really big part of depth hypnosis. And, you know, I would say that 40% of the individual sessions that I do with anyone are driven by dreams, because there's so much insight that's coming through them. And it's really just a matter of learning the language, and I highly, highly, highly recommend it. Your intuition that there's more to learn through your dreams is absolutely correct.
She's very right, and it's very economical if you work with that kind of instruction, and you can get back into your dreams and your unconscious much quicker than the talking thing. So many hours, it's so much per hour. You go much faster with that.
No.
But it's kind of dream yoga, so it's very economical. Right. Can I tell a quick story to end?
Of course.
I'm going to tell a story. I think his name was Kadgapa. I really should get up one of these days and stop saying I think. But I believe so. And there was this guy who was banished by his family. But Nagarjuna came to this town. And there was a guy in the cemetery, which isn't a cemetery with gravestones in India, and with bodies are thrown there, or ashes of people burned who have more money to afford the fire. So it's called the charnel ground. And there was a guy lying in the charnel ground weeping. So Nagarjuna said, "What's the matter with you?" He was well-dressed, and he was a good-looking guy. He said, "What's your problem? Why are you weeping?" He said, "Well, the only thing I like to do is sleep. That's the only thing in life that I enjoy. Sleeping. So I do sleep all the time, and my wife and my mother and my father and everyone, they have said to me, if you're going to be comatose and just act like you're in a coma all the time, why don't you just go ahead of time to the cemetery, or to the charnel ground?" So they dumped me here, and now I think I might die or something, but I can't change because all I want to do is sleep. So then Nagarjuna said, "Well, that's great. If you could have a practice, a teaching that you could practice by sleeping, would you like that?" "Oh yes, please teach me that." So then Nagarjuna taught him what they call the mixing. Well, they initiated him first in a certain mandala, this esoteric community mandala. But then, and then he said, and now in this context, you must mix your sleep state with the clear light state. So that your sleeping itself, just your seemingly unconscious sleeping, is immersion in the clear light. And you're combining the clear light of samadhi, the clear light of sleeping, and the clear light of death, all as one thing of the clear light of the void, of the dharma body, the reality body of the Buddha. So all great. So then the guy, they went to sleep. And then Nagarjuna left, you know, and he slept and slept and slept. And then the people, you know, his wife tried to sneak out thinking, you know, she'd take him some food, he might die. So, and they were all waiting for him to reform, you know, to come back and eat and be a member of the family. But he just kept sleeping. So she sneaked out, and then she was shocked because she saw all these deities, like Taras and Dakinis and spirits, you know. And they were there, and they were feasting him in his subtle body. You know, he was asleep, but there was all this going on around him. And then after 12 years of sleeping, his sleeping body started levitating, and he started floating down the main street of the town. And then, without waking up, he started giving like Dharma lectures. He started giving depth hypnosis therapy to everybody in the town. While still asleep. I particularly like that because that's a Buddhist version of sleeping your way to Buddhahood. Okay? So have a nice sleep, everyone. Thank you. We're going to do the circle.
We're going to do the circle. Circle.
This podcast was sponsored by Menla Retreat, located in Phoenicia, New York, just 2 hours north of New York City. We will be hosting Bob and Issa this fall in the program Shamans and Siddhas. For more information, please visit menla.us or bobthurman.com. Weekly interstitial music provided by Tenzin Chogyal. All rights reserved.